It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Sasha Abramsky. Sasha Abramsky is a senior fellow at Demos, a national public policy institute based in New York. He has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, the LA Times, the Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, and the London Independent. He is author of the book Hard Time Blues, How Politics Built a Prison Nation, and he is here to talk about his new book, Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. Sasha, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's begin, and if you could tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Conned?
Well, for about a decade now, I've done a lot of work looking at how the expansion of the criminal justice system has impacted America's economy and its America's politics. And about 7 or 8 years ago, a couple of years before the 2000 election, I almost accidentally stumbled upon some very arcane laws that were still on the books in a lot of states that said if you had a felony conviction, you could never again vote. And it seemed to me this was, A, somewhat perplexing given the way that we define ourselves as a democratic country, and B, since we were putting so many people into prison and giving so many people felony records, it was starting to have a huge impact on the electoral process. Now, that was the sort of background. Obviously, the real catalyst came in 2000. In 2000, everyone remembers the Florida election deadlocks between Al Gore and George Bush. Now, about 6 million people voted in that election in Florida. About 750,000 Floridians, 750,000 Floridians, had been legally told they couldn't vote because they were either in prison, on parole or probation, or, for about 500,000 of them, had been to prison or acquired a felony record in the past. So the more I researched this, the more amazed I became by the actual tangible impact this was having on politics. So that's the motivation for the book. 2004, I actually set off around the country with a sort of mandate, I guess, to look at the underside of the election, to go to all the states where there were real hotspots of disenfranchisement, and to report on what it meant both to the individuals who couldn't vote and more generally to the election itself. So there's the background to my book.
All right. So where would be a logical place to start? I know that Seattle and Washington State figured into your book.
Yeah, I was trying to work out how to tell the story, and since I was 20 years old, I've always had this fascination with driving around America. The first car I ever bought, I came over from England with a couple of friends, we bought this beat-up old Ford LTD, and we spent 10 weeks driving around America. And ever since then, if I have a few days spare, that's what I'll do. I'll get on the road, and I'll explore the country. Now, I was trying to work out, how do you tell a story of disenfranchisement? Everybody might recognize it's an important topic, but how do you make it an interesting topic? And I decided I would tell it as a road trip. I'd drive around America, or I'd fly and I'd drive around America, and I'd go to all these places where people were being disenfranchised in large numbers, and I'd talk to them, and I'd talk to their politicians, and I'd talk to the people who were lobbying on the issue, and I'd talk to family members of the disenfranchised. So I decided to do that. At the same time, I had been reading Alexis de Tocqueville, and de Tocqueville was this French aristocrat. He came over to America in the 1830s, and he had this idea that he would chronicle the emergence of a democratic culture. He'd never heard of anything like this in Europe. It was something entirely new in human history. De Tocqueville spent 9 months going around what was a much smaller America, chronicling the story of modern democracy emerging. So when I began writing Conned, I picked up a copy of de Tocqueville's work, and I decided he'd be my traveling companion. And as I'd go across country looking at the contraction of democracy, I'd have de Tocqueville on my shoulder as a sort of voice from the past talking about the possibilities of democracy. Now, in terms of where to start, obviously when you're doing a road trip, a logical place is California. But the problem from my perspective is, for a book on disenfranchisement, California doesn't actually permanently disenfranchise. On the other hand, Washington has a much closer approximation to permanent disenfranchisement. It lets people get back into the system, but it places all kind of legal obstacles in the way, and it makes it very, very hard for many ex-felons to get their voting rights restored. So I think it was last May or June of 2004, I flew up to Seattle, did a lot of research here, and I did a lot of research in Spokane, where there was some legal work being done on it. And that was the origin point of my journey that ultimately took me all the way across to Florida.
So how does Washington State compare to the other states?
Well, Washington, going into the 2000 election, which is when disenfranchisement became this really critical national issue, Washington was one of about a dozen states that the ACLU and various other groups defined as having permanent disenfranchisement. Now, that didn't mean that everybody who got a felony was forever disenfranchised. What it meant was a lot of people who got felonies had a form of disenfranchisement that was very hard to overcome. One of the things that makes it so hard to overcome in Florida, until the law was actually changed, I believe, by the courts last week, is that going into 2000 and 2004's election, Washington State, I apologize, had this series of laws that said you had to pay off all your court costs and all your fines before you could vote. Now, it sounds good in theory. The problem is there are an awful lot of people in Washington who've been convicted of low-end crimes, served their sentences, come back into the community, and they have low-wage jobs, and they're working hard, and they're trying their best to stay legal, but they're unable to pay their court costs, and those costs accumulate interest every year. Now, the result is you have many, many thousands of people in Washington who, going into the last couple elections, literally couldn't vote despite the fact they were paying taxes, were law-abiding, were to all intents and purposes rehabilitated members of the community. It was a huge problem. It also fell disproportionately on the state's African-American population. Now, most states that have this cumulative disenfranchisement, this permanent disenfranchisement, because of the war on drugs and because of the way the criminal justice system in general has played out in recent decades, the disenfranchisement falls disproportionately on African-Americans. And in Washington, going into the last election, somewhere in the region of 1 in 4 black men were voteless. It's an extraordinary number. So for all of these reasons, I decided this was a very good place to start my research.
And how do those 1 in 4 numbers match up to other parts of the country?
Well, what you see is all over the country, in states that have something approximate to permanent disenfranchisement, somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 black men cannot vote. In some states, it's higher than 1 in 4. In parts of the Mississippi Delta, in parts of Alabama, estimates are it's 1 in 3. It's an absolutely extraordinary number of people. Now, we have this idea in America that we've had a couple hundred years of almost one-directional progress towards the universal adult franchise. So we have a narrative that says we went from just allowing propertied white males to vote to allowing all white males to vote to allowing all whites, including females, to vote, and finally in the civil rights era, to allowing African Americans to vote as well. We have this idea that we're progressively more democratic. And to a degree, that narrative is true, but there are two moments in American history where the franchise has gone in the exact opposite direction, where less people have become eligible to vote. The two moments are the imposition of Jim Crow, about 15 years after the end of the Civil War, when millions of freed black slaves who for about 10 to 15 years had been politically participatory were suddenly removed from the voting process. That's the first great contraction. The second one has occurred without anyone noticing, really, over the last 20 years as our prison systems expanded. And that's what I've been writing about, the idea that over the last 20 years, our franchise has gone into reverse. It's gone into reverse because of policy decisions we made about crime and punishment, and it's falling disproportionately on the poorest and the most marginalized sectors of the community.
And what kind of numbers are we looking at over the last 20 years?
The numbers are huge. The best guess estimates are that nationally today, about 5 million Americans are legally prevented from casting votes. And about 2 million of those 5 million are ex-prisoners. They're out of prison, they're off of parole, they're off of probation, they live in the community, but they live in states like Alabama, Virginia, Tennessee, Florida, a couple other states that do not make it easy to get voting rights restored. It's a huge number. If you go to Alabama and Florida, somewhere in the region of 7% of all adults in the state can't vote.
And where, maybe briefly, where did this idea of removing one's right to vote once you are found guilty of a crime come from?
In their very earliest incarnations, these laws come out of medieval Europe. There was a concept in Europe at the time called civil death. Now, Europe had a very brutal penal code. If you were convicted of crimes, you were generally either maimed or transported or executed. Now, obviously, if you're executed, that's the punishment. But if you're maimed and you're walking around, let's say, with a limb cut off, and you've got the mark of a felon on you, in certain European countries, they would impose on you what was called civil death. And what that meant was the state was withdrawing all protections from you. Anybody could do anything they liked to you with no penalty. It morphs over into the American context. In colonial era America, local communities began sort of informally banishing criminals from town meetings. In the more recent context, you see this rash of permanent disenfranchisement laws put into state constitutions in the 1840s. And it's very interesting. They start emerging at the same time that the franchise for non-felons is increasing. And there's this sort of school of historical thought around this that says that the political elite was very, very nervous of a sort of dangerous, lumpen underclass gaining political control. And they began casting around for restrictions on the franchise. So at the moment that the vote is actually increasing, you see whole categories, felons and other categories, being excluded. Now, it takes a racial twist in the 1870s and 1880s when the southern states are rewriting their constitutions and they impose Jim Crow. They create poll taxes, literacy tests, and so on. At the same time, they very consciously use their felon codes to disenfranchise blacks, and they do it in two ways. One way, they just informally assume that local law enforcement will arrest more blacks than whites and will process more blacks through the criminal justice system. The second way they do it in some states is they create different categories of crimes that they think are based around racial propensities. So in Mississippi, for example, in the 1870s and 80s, they create laws that say if you're convicted of murder, which at the time was a white crime or thought to be a white crime, you could vote. But if you're convicted of stealing food, which was thought to be a crime of a sort of vagrant black underclass, you can't vote. Now, those laws have been somewhat ironed out in recent decades, so Mississippi doesn't have such an obvious racial discrimination in its disenfranchisement. But that's the origins of where those laws come from in the South. Now, most states, to a degree, have had permanent disenfranchisement at one point or another in their history. Very few states in America have never had it. Most states, though, abandoned it in the 1950s and 60s. As part of the sort of civil rights revolution, most states got rid of permanent disenfranchisement, leaving a rump of about a dozen states. And it's in these dozen states that you see this absolutely draconian denial of voting rights to whole categories of people, to many hundreds of thousands in states like Virginia and Alabama and Florida.
All right. But within the states that no longer have permanent disenfranchisement, is it, you know, automatic enfranchisement?
It's automatic enfranchisement, but with a caveat. And the caveat is that there really isn't much voter awareness about the automatic enfranchisement. And there also isn't much awareness about these laws among election officials and correctional officials. And this is important because if you go around the country like I did and you talk to ex-prisoners, even in states where in theory they can vote, over and over again, you'll be told both by the ex-prisoners and also by correctional officials and elections officials that felons can't vote. It's a street rumor mill, and it's a very, very powerful street rumor mill. And it creates what I call a secondary level of disenfranchisement, an informal cultural denial of access to the ballot, because enough people are saying over and over again, you can't vote with a felony record, that it becomes accepted knowledge. So a couple examples. I went to Utah and Montana, both of them states that in theory have a relatively liberal restoration of voting rights process. I went to those states because I'd been told that very few felons were aware of these laws, and there were groups that were out there in both states trying to increase awareness. So there was a very sort of active voting rights battle going on to increase the awareness of ex-felons. Now, it works to a degree. You go to Utah, for example, and there are groups led by little old ladies in their 70s and 80s who go out to prison with voter registration forms, and they literally register these men to vote as they step out of the prison gates. That clearly gets a few people back into the process. On the other hand, in Montana, there's a woman called Casey Rudd who has compiled thousands of interviews with ex-felons, and she showed me the results, and the results overwhelmingly are that the ex-felons just do not understand that they have political rights. So this is a huge problem. As we put more and more people into prison, as we have more and more families with at least one member in prison, what I argue in my book is that we're actually undermining the culture of democracy. We're undermining the affinity that we as individuals have with the political institutions that govern us. I think it's a very unhealthy thing for a democracy.
Sounds like it's undemocratic, the current system we have.
Well, the permanent disenfranchisement laws are very, very hard to defend given our understanding of democracy, our modern understanding of democracy, as something almost synonymous with the idea of universal adult suffrage. So I think in a state like Florida or Alabama, there's something absolutely anti-democratic about the laws. In the broader national context, this issue of a sort of informal disenfranchisement through rumor and through misinformation, I'm not sure I'd call it anti-democratic. In a sense, I'd call it ademocratic. What I mean by that is we're almost just ceasing to care enough about the democratic institutions that govern our country to really invest the time and energy to understand how they function. Now, when you look at history, Rome, for example, after it ceased to be a formal democracy and became an empire, it retained the trappings of an electoral system. It retained the Senate, it retained the consulship, it retained all of the organized institutions that in theory should have allowed the citizenry to make decisions about how they were governed. In practice, though, these institutions ossified. They just ceased to matter. Power was concentrated with the emperors, and these institutions became little more than debating chambers or talking shops. Now, obviously, historical analogies are difficult, but I do think it's a prescient one to look at, that America today is extraordinarily powerful. We concentrate extraordinary power in our executive. We still have all of the trappings of democracy. We have elections to everything from the school board through to Congress through to the presidency. But we're in a moment in time where fewer and fewer Americans are actually connecting to those democratic processes. Fewer Americans are participating. Fewer are bothering to vote. Partly that's because they're being told they can't vote. Partly it's because there's just this general alienation from the institutions. Now, I hope very profoundly that we can reverse this trend, that we can restore some kind of visceral faith in our democratic institutions. I'm not sure how we can do that at the same time that we're saying to 5 million Americans, we don't want you to vote. So I do think it's a very, very powerful problem we're facing.
Are there any states that allow prisoners to vote?
There are two states that do, Maine and Vermont, and as far as I know, they always have. There were a couple other states that into the 1990s did, then they toughened up their laws a bit. The two states that do, Maine and Vermont, nobody's managed to show that it's had a deleterious effect on their system. Nobody's managed to show that felons are organizing into a coherent voting bloc and undermining existing laws or weakening support for law enforcement. When you broaden it to international affairs, South Africa, Israel, a couple other countries routinely let prisoners vote. And again, there's no evidence that the strength of their democratic institutions is weakened by this. In America, when you look at national polling data, there isn't much national support for allowing people in prison to vote. That's not where the terms of the debate are at the moment. What there is a huge majority support nationally to re-enfranchise ex-prisoners. So that's where I think the focus of the political battle at the moment is. It's on states like Alabama and Florida, to a lesser extent states like Washington, that impose these post-prison restrictions on voting.
So after Washington, were you surprised as you traveled across the country what you found?
I was surprised by the level of desire to vote expressed by many, many ex-prisoners. I'd sort of gone into this story thinking, well, it's an interesting philosophical conundrum. It clearly had an impact on the Florida election in 2000, but that was quite possibly a statistical anomaly because election races rarely dead heat like that. What I found when I went around the country and I talked to people was this was far more than a philosophical inequity. It actually was affecting people very, very profoundly as individuals. And I talked to people in Nashville, a woman called Jamaica, for example, who's featured quite prominently in my book, who said to me that not being able to vote made her feel like an untouchable in a caste system, that it made her feel like this utter sub-citizen. I spoke to people in Iowa at a drug rehabilitation center there who talked to me about how it made them feel like they had no country because their country had said that it didn't want them to play a part in its politics. I spoke to people in Montana, again, in a sort of halfway house, post-prison halfway house, who also told me about this sort of burning desire to vote and this utter inability to work out how to vote. All over the country, I spoke to people who'd gone through the hoops trying to get their vote back. In Virginia, I talked to a man who'd spent a decade filing paperwork with the state. And every time he filed the paperwork, he was sent back something saying, you've got to wait a few more years, you've got to file another document, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Finally, he gets a governor in office who's sympathetic to the idea of re-enfranchisement. He applies again, and he's told, "We're sorry, the previous governor's administration lost all your paperwork. You're going to have to start from scratch." This guy had tried to start voting again in the early 1990s. As of 2004, he still couldn't vote. His story wasn't an anomaly. All over the country, I found these stories of people who really were trying, going out of their way to get reconnected politically. They viewed it as an integral part of their rehabilitation, as important as getting a job, as important as paying taxes, as important as re-establishing ties with their own families. And instead of helping them, in about 12 to 13 states in the country, the governors and the governments were actively hindering their political re-enfranchisement. It's a very depressing state of affairs for me. So you asked me, you know, what did I find interesting? I just found it staggering. A, the level of desire to vote amongst this population grouping, and B, the hindrances that they're facing.
But it sounds like it goes even farther than just those 12 or 13 states, because you've got those are actively hindering people, yeah. And then you've got the other ones that just aren't helping to let people know.
That's right. And in states like New York, it goes beyond not helping people to know. There's actual misinformation being given out. New York, for example, has been a lot of the election boards have been asking ex-prisoners for something called a proof of eligibility to vote. Well, A, it's illegal to demand that kind of document, and B, in New York, that document doesn't exist. So the Brennan Center and DeMos and a couple other groups that have studied this essentially believe that the elections officials are breaking their own laws by, in practice, encouraging a form of disenfranchisement. So yes, the problem goes way beyond those 12 or 13 states. Clearly, though, it's exacerbated in a state like Florida, where legally about 7% of adults can't vote.
So what do you see as solutions here?
Well, in a state like New York, the solution is clearly putting money and effort into voter education, ensuring that elections officials are properly trained on this law. That's one thing. In states which have actually more restrictive franchises, it's a political battle. Basically, it involves convincing legislatures that this isn't a narrow criminal justice issue, that it's a broad access to the ballot issue, that it's a broad civil rights issue. You're seeing that in states like Alabama, in particular, the African American caucus has been all over the issue of disenfranchisement. They've turned it into a civil rights issue. They're defining it using the language of civil rights. That's as it should be, because the criminal justice system is playing itself out for many very complicated reasons, but it's playing itself out in a way that has an extremely disproportionate racial impact. So I think if I had to guess what's going to happen, I'd say over the next 5 to 6 years, a couple other of the states will get rid of disenfranchisement. There's already been several states since 2000 that removed their disenfranchisement provisions. Several states in the South especially will be holdout states. They'll fight very hard to preserve disenfranchisement because it ties in to a historically much more narrow understanding of what the suffrage is and who it should be available for. And in those states, I think you'll see a really large political battle shaping up, especially Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Virginia.
Why do you think this issue doesn't get more coverage, even, let's say, in the alternative media?
I find it very hard to fathom. I mean, I talk about this in my book. If one in four white men in any state was disenfranchised, we'd be up in arms. The media would be up in arms saying something fundamental is happening to our democracy. You can't have taxation without representation, etc., etc., all of which is true. But if you go to state after state in America today, one in four or one in five black men cannot vote, and in many states will never again be able to vote. And there hasn't been a media outcry. I don't know why. I don't believe in a sort of meta-racial conspiracy. I don't think that's what's going on. I think what's happening is that this generally falls on the most marginalized, weakest parts of society. It generally falls on the people who never have had a voice, who the media doesn't generally talk to anyway when it's writing stories. And I think if I had to sort of hazard a guess as to why this hasn't gotten more coverage, I'd say it's probably because this is a story about people who are, to all intents and purposes, invisible in our society. And as long as they're invisible, it's going to be very, very hard to get mainstream or alternative media up in arms about this issue. Now, hopefully, with a book like mine and with some of the other work that's been done on this, people will start thinking about it a bit more. But I'm under no illusions. This is going to be, you know, an issue which takes time to fully percolate into the mainstream.
Again, what do you hope to accomplish with this book?
I hope to make this more of an issue that's in the public eye and in the public consciousness. In my more optimistic moments, I'd hope, obviously, that it would also impact the policy debate. And I think to a degree it has. Last week in Tennessee, legislators for the first time actually voted to simplify and streamline their disenfranchisement provisions. Didn't vote to abolish fairly restrictive disenfranchisement. But Tennessee had the most incomprehensible system in the country. They had five or six different kinds of disenfranchisement dependent on when you were convicted, because the law had changed in the mid-70s, in the late 70s, in the early 80s, etc., etc. And nobody understood the law in Tennessee. So last week, legislators voted to just make a one-size-fits-all approach to getting your vote back. Not a panacea to the problem, but it's certainly a stepping stone. And I know that my book was a sort of component part of that debate. I would hope that over the next few months, the issue is more broadly aired, especially in states like Alabama and Florida, and that in being more broadly aired, gradually there's more of a momentum built towards changing the laws. So in my optimistic moments, that, I guess, is what I hope my book will do.
Do you see the situation in Maine and Vermont as being ideal? Is that something that you'd like to see implemented across the board?
I think there's a lot of room for debate on that issue. What I'm very clear about is that if somebody has done their time, they've served their sentence, they're being trusted enough to come back into the community, at that point, to me, it's extremely hard to craft a philosophical argument defending their continued disenfranchisement. I do think that it's a legitimate political debate as to whether or not somebody who's in prison currently should have full voting rights. Now, I go back and forth on this issue. If the prison population was restricted to hardcore, violent, predatory criminals, personally, I'm not sure I'd be up in arms about a group of murderers and rapists and robbers not being able to vote while they're in prison. The complicating factor is that over the last 30 years, we've dramatically expanded our prison system. We're now putting into prison a huge number of low-level offenders, including a huge number of very, very low-end drug offenders. Now, I have a much stronger philosophical problem with disenfranchising those. I'm not sure you can make a coherent link between somebody being arrested with a marijuana joint and whether or not they should have political rights. So given the fact that states like Florida and Texas and California and New York now have tens of thousands, in some states hundreds of thousands of people behind bars or on parole or probation, at that point I think it becomes much more ethically problematic to deprive them of the vote. So I'm not saying that we should all immediately go down the Maine-Vermont route, but I do think we should have an open debate about why we're disenfranchising so many prisoners, and at the same time an open debate about why we're putting so many very low-end offenders into prison in a way that we didn't used to, and in a way that other countries today don't.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
We have just been talking with Sasha Abramski, author of Cond, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. And again, he is speaking this afternoon, 2 o'clock, at Elliott Bay Books.